Welcome to Tales of Northern Michigan's Past. I'm your host, Christopher Struble, and today we continue our conversation with Valerie Hemingway, author of Running with the Bulls. So in the previous episode, you left us with a great story about Orson Welles and the types of people you would have come in contact with while dealing, being part of Hemingway's entourage. I can only imagine, did you meet several celebrities of the era during your time with him?
Well, I did, but you know, I wasn't tuned into celebrities, so that sometimes I didn't know till afterwards that they were celebrities. I mean, I met Lauren Bacall. She was there a couple of times. You know, there were people. I mean, for me, it was writers. So we met the French poet Jacques Prévert, and that was for me a big excitement. Also, the painter Luis Quintanilla. All his paintings were, up to that point, were burnt by the Franco regime in the Spanish Civil War. And Hemingway, he really, his friends who had bad fortune, he made a point of keeping in touch with them and trying to help them out financially over the years. And when there was a, Quintanilla had, a, he helped arrange for a show in New York of Quintanilla's work. And later that would have been, well, I'd have to, I think, the 40s. But he wrote an introduction to the catalogue for that. And when Lillian Ross did her profile of Hemingway in the New Yorker, and that was in 49, or 50 it might have come out in, Ernest had Quintanilla do, he used a couple of sketches that Quintanilla did of him for that piece. So he was always trying to help his friends. I mean, that his generosity was amazing. So for me, even again, Lillian Ross, for me, it was the writers, not so much the actors that I met over the years with him, over the couple of years. It wasn't many years, of course, but yes, I'm trying to think if there were other, because I never thought in terms of people as celebrities. I think of people as people, and sure, then they might incidentally be celebrities. Because we have, going back to that era, to the 1950s, you know, that was just the beginning of, you know, that was sort of maybe the Elvis period, the mm-hmm. period when people became celebrities. In the 19th and early 20th century, writers, you know, really were in their little office or their whatever, their study writing. They were not, they really weren't, you know, public figures.
Yeah, it's Hemingway.
Wasn't really until television came along, or even perhaps it started with radio, with, you know, but it was not a cult of my growing up.
Was it Cuba or was it the trip through Paris as he's sort of retracing his footsteps for his memoir, which became A Movable Feast? Which came first?
Sorry, that was in Paris. Paris, that was in a part of the Spanish trip when we were in Spain. The very end of the season, when the bullfighters fighting in Spain, they then go up to France. And in France, I don't think there might be one place, but generally in France, the bull is not killed. It's more a spectacle, you know, not this big tragedy of the bull being killed. So, and then it was when Ernest had wanted to see a couple of fights, bull fights in the south of France, he coupled that with going up to Paris, which we did on two occasions, to see, well, he wanted to check out his manuscript, A Movable Feast, to see if he'd made, if he was accurate in where he, when he described places, was that where it was? Had he remembered? Because when he wrote the book, he wasn't in Paris when he wrote the book. He always said that it was easier to write about a place when you weren't living in it. So many of his short stories about Michigan were written when he was in Paris.
Yeah, it was
so
very common.
So he was in Cuba when he wrote about the Paris. Mostly it was in Cuba when he wrote A Movable Feast.
Yeah, you'd think it would be just the opposite, but he had to move on before he would write about the place prior. Mm-hmm. And again, that great memory of his.
Yes, but he was able to evoke these places when he was far away from them better. And I don't know, in some ways I can understand that.
Well, you know, me too,
we remember things, we remember them vividly. often when we're not close to them.
Speaking of memories, too, now is this the gentleman approached you about a famous car you mentioned in the book. Remember 2 weeks ago, he wanted to know what happened with the car. Now, that car was in a car accident. That was part of that same trip?
Yes, the car was the car that Ernest bought for himself for his birthday with his Italian royalties. It was a Lancia, and it came over from Italy. It was driven with the chauffeur that he'd had on a previous trip to where he'd gone from. He'd driven from Spain to France, and he liked that driver very much. But he thought the thing was, in those days, it was very difficult to get royalties from another country to get them to America. So usually what you had to do was to go to that country and spend the royalties there. And so that's why he had quite a few royalties from Italy. And he thought, well, why don't I? We were renting a car. They were renting a car in Spain from the end of April, the 1st of May to November. So it was 6 months. And he said, well, why don't I treat myself to a car with the royalties? And for the first 2 weeks, the chauffeur drove us around. And then Bill Davis took over. And it wasn't long after, it was within the first month, I think, that we were coming down. Actually, we were coming down from the south of France, from Biarritz or thereabouts. And it was midday or just early afternoon. And we were coming right due south, right into the sun. And Bill, I think temporarily, we'd had a lunch at Burgos, a lovely lunch there. And I think Bill sort of, he nodded off and the car went off the road. And that was quite a shock for all of us because I think we were all nodding off. And there we were. And the car had to go off to the back to the factory and get sorted out. But it wasn't too badly injured.
The locals, did some locals come and help? And were they surprised by a certain package that was in the car?
The thing is that we were in, it was funny because we had been, we'd been in the south, it was in Andai. I think we spent the night, either we spent the night at a hotel or we stayed with these people. We certainly had breakfast with them in the morning and they gave Ernest a present. The present was a shrunken head from Peru.
Oh my Lord.
And for some reason Ernest called it Lady Luck, and it was in a hat box, and that got I don't know, I think it got rolled out of the back had opened with the crash and the great crunch that happened. The back had opened and the hat, Lady Luck had fallen out, and Ernest picked it up and he was looking at it, and all these people who were working in the field, you know, came walking over to see what happened. You know, this car, it's off the road and it's in a, we were sort of in a ditch and Ernest had this shrunken head in his hand. And I remember he held it up and said in Spanish, you know, here's Lady Luck. You know, that's what Lady Luck has brought us today.
How lucky can you be if you have a shrunken head?
They must have thought, what is this? These strangers in the car that's now crashed and the sort of mashed up a bit. And he's holding this shrunken, you know, head. I can't even imagine what those people thought but anyway, he did keep the head, but he must have given it to Bill and Davis. Bill and Annie. He didn't bring it back to the States. But I'd forgotten actually about that particular incident.
I remember those things kind of resonate sometimes in your memory.
Yeah, and then that evening when we were asked about the car, it actually, at the end of the time we were there, Ernest said, he actually left, he parked the car at Bill and Annie Davis's, And he offered me that. He just said, this is a gift for you. But I said, I have no use for a car. I don't know how to drive a car. I don't have a license. I've nowhere to bring it. I don't have a, you know, I was just about to start my career. And having a car in Dublin, I mean, it just wasn't of any sense to me. So the car stayed at Bill and Annie Davis's. And after Ernest died, Gianfranco Ivancic in Italy, his great friend, a younger friend who would have been the age of his children, Gianfranco received the car. Mary gave it, it wasn't in the will, but Mary gave it to Gianfranco, which made most sense because it's an Italian car, and it was Gianfranco who often was a liaison with Ernest's Italian publishers, so that so it was a good thing for Gianfranco to have it. That person seemed to be very disappointed that it wasn't in some museum somewhere.
Yes,
that
yes, he was there. He was
his hands on it. I imagine Gianfranco, if I know him, knew him pretty well, he would have probably run it to its last. What he had, he died in his late 90s, so, and he would have been, I don't know, maybe in his 40s then, so he had about 50 years
to enjoy that vehicle.
Run it down.
Well, then we 2 weeks ago, we kind of transitioned into the Cuba years, and you got a big laugh because I said, you know, what was it like in Cuba during that period? You said, well, we did have the inconvenience of Castro. And
Well, that's true. I mean, we had, well, for me, it was, I mean, coming from my experience, I'd grown up in Ireland where it was damp and cold, and just to live in a place where it was sunny and beautiful flowers year round and that. Of course, you know, now I'm working on editing Hemingway's letters with Jerry Kennedy and Michael von Cannon. But he has many grumps about the weather there, because there are all sorts of things like hurricanes and more inconveniences like Castro, but to upset your living there. But for me, it was absolute heaven, you know, my first experience, because when I was when I was in Spain and was in Madrid, I was there in the winter, and the winter was every bit as cold as in Dublin, and the high mountains around the city, it was snow and that. And then we were just so busy during the time when we were in Malaga, which would have been really hot, but we were in the car going here, there, and everywhere, going to the different bullfights. We were just on the road so much that the weather wasn't something that I even thought about for most of the time I was in Spain. But in Cuba, the Hemingways had a very leisurely life compared, because they really enjoyed the finca, and he wrote every morning, and then he went swimming in the pool, and then he 2 days a week he went out fishing on the Gulf Coast, on the Gulf Stream with his boat, the Pilar, and I got to go with him on all these things. But we did, you know, it was far more leisurely, and it was very much we were thrown to our own devices. There wasn't a quadrilla. There weren't eight people around us all the time. In fact, mostly we were alone with, well, they had quite a few servants in the house, which was the norm in those days. And but generally, we had our meals, just the three of us together. Except that each day of the week, except Sunday when the servants were off, we had one or two people who came to dinner, his close friends, Dr. Coco Coley. In this case, the Americans had, the women had all returned to America. So because of the Castro regime and the probability that this was no longer a viable place for American citizens to live. So that it was mostly, in fact, it was all guys who came. The two brothers, Herrera, Feo, which means ugly. Jose Luis was called Feo, but he was wonderful. He was a doctor, and his brother Roberto, who was a photographer, and also sometimes secretary for Ernest. And they came one night, Coca-Cola, a doctor came another night, the American ambassador came third night, Lee Samuels came either for lunch, he usually came for lunch one day rather than in the evening. So we had, there were a pattern of people, but they were just one or two people at a time, and he concentrated completely on them, the people he'd known for many years, the Herreras he'd met during the Spanish Civil War. I think he knew the ambassador. He'd known him somewhere else before. It was, instead of having 10 to 20 people every time you sat down or around you all the time, he just had one or two, and very seldom three even. So Cuba was an entirely a different experience, but equally interesting and fun, you know.
And he enjoyed the anonymity, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they had a gatehouse with a gatehouse. The gate was always locked, and nobody was allowed in without calling up to the house to see that they, you know, that they were invited or expected. The little children from the village, they were able to climb over the wall, and Ernest didn't mind that so much because they came to pick the fruit, to get the mangoes. There was something like 18 or more mango trees. So there were more mango trees than, you know, they could eat the mangoes. So he was, you know, it amused him. He didn't open the gate for the kids, but if they were adventurous enough to climb over the wall, then they deserved the mangoes, he felt. So and, he was good like that.
And he had the beloved baseball team, and so the locals appreciated him.
Well, that was during, the baseball team was during the time that his boys were, you know, they between the ages of like 10 and 15, when they came home from school, he created the baseball team so that when his sons were home, they'd built in sports.
Yes.
Teams to play with, you know, that, and that no longer existed when I was there, because all those, in fact, some of those people who were on the baseball team were part of the staff. Rene Villarreal, mm-hmm. and two or three others had started out as baseballers at the age of seven or eight, I think, was the age that he started them at, and he actually trained them himself.
And now Hemingway, his relationship with Castro was probably complicated, but they didn't really have any real skirmishes or anything. And it wasn't, I think people believe that was Hemingway's reason for leaving Cuba. It wasn't on Castro's insistence. Is that correct? It was more the United States pressuring him?
Castro really wanted him to stay. But the American government asked all Americans to leave Cuba. And they specifically asked Hemingway, the ambassador, Phil Bonsall, came one Thursday, was his dinner day, and he came and asked us asked Hemingway, if he must, well, actually told him rather than asked him, that he had to consider leaving because it was felt he was a public figure and it was an affront to the States if he stayed there. Since Americans were requested to leave. And Hemingway sort of, he was astounded, and he said, well, I've been here long before Castro. Many governments have come. There have been other revolutions. I'm not here as a political person. I'm here as a writer who wants anonymity and wants to be able to write without being bothered. And I think Bonsall was said, well, you know, this is a very tricky situation, and you need to leave. Mm-hmm. And that was he had a difficult time because his good friend from the Spanish Civil War, the New York Times reporter Herbert Matthews, came down in that March of 60. And he had been a great champion of Castro, and he had been up in the mountains, the Sierras, with Castro before, when he was planning the revolution and before it happened. And and Matthews was on hand at the time of the revolution, was able to give a scoop to the New York Times. But now this was 2 years on, a year and a half on, and the relationship had soured between Castro and the U.S., and it was becoming apparent that all Americans, you know, not from Castro's point of view, because he would have loved to have Americans stay there, but that that they had to, you know, that the Americans said, you need to leave. This is an enemy country, and you don't live in an enemy country.
Yes, of course.
And so, but that was a very difficult moment for Hemingway, and really, I think, precipitated the depression that led to his demise.
Yeah, and bringing that up, the end, you're currently working on the letters, so it's the Penn State collection, right, the letters of Ernest Hemingway, thousands and thousands of letters, and you're working retro because these are letters that you would have possibly written or you know, dictated, read back.
Yeah, these are the letters are in my handwriting, a lot of them, and the handwriting was difficult to decipher, and that's why they recruited me.
And
also, I used the English spelling, and my spelling, Hemingway's spelling was poor, and my spelling was poor, so he didn't berate me when I met. Well, I don't know that he even ever looked at I've convinced now that he never looked at the letters that I wrote, that he just signed them, because you know, there's just about never, I think there's only one that I noticed that he actually put a little you know, changed something in it, but it really was a huge surprise for me, because he had told me from the very beginning. I mean, two things. When he hired me, first thing he said was, you do not, if you live with me, work for me, and travel with me and my family, you do not write about me. He said, you'll have lots of adventures with plenty of things to write about, but I'm not one of them, and you must agree that or I can't hire you. And I did, which is why it was so many years before I ever published anything. Well, except, you know, I published in the Saturday Review, you know, when A Movable Feast came out, they asked me to do a piece about that. I mean, I didn't publish anything about his personal life, because that was off bounds as far as I was concerned. You know, I kept to that until people, you know, when people went through, how many years, 40 years or so of biography after biography, and then they were running out of all sorts of material, and then they sort of said, well, what about that Irish girl that was around? You know, there must be something there, you know? And that's when I decided to publish my book, because I felt, well, I'm just going to say Mary's book was how it was, but I'm saying how it was for me.
Yes.
During that period, there's no big, you know, big scandal or surprise or whatever. It was just, I was young and very lucky to have that experience. And, you know, he was a wonderful employer and friend and so on, you know, and really I was treated as part of the family. And that continued with Mary after he died, you know.
No,
she asked me to go down to Cuba with her and recover all the papers and some of the paintings, which are now in the National Gallery in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, and we had the one chapter in between. You mentioned, contrary to all the scholars out there, you feel that his diminishing sort of mental capabilities at that time, it came much later. I mean, he was still quite lucid up the majority of the time.
He was lucid. I would say he was lucid until he died, but he was very depressed. The depression started in May of 1960, but there's even until, you know, until the end of 1960, when I think he saw there was no turning back. He saw that there was no chance to return to Cuba, and that was, you know, there was his library, the animals that he loved. I mean, it was his one home. They hadn't, you know, they weren't a two-home people until it was in January of 59 that they when Castro got in was when they bought the house in Ketchum. But it had nothing to do with Castro. It was that they had been going out there intermittently, not every year, but they'd been going out there and they were enjoying it more and more. And because they went out there during the season of the hurricanes, and when they were and for the fall to hunt, and they had been renting, and they found that sometimes they wanted to stay through the end of the year, but the rentals ended. There was the fall hunting season, and then skiing began in Ketchum and Sun Valley, and they started having to, if they wanted to stay longer, they had to rent a second thing, and that became just a nuisance, moving out and renting for 3 or 4 weeks before going back to Cuba. And they said, well, the smartest thing is for us to buy a hunting lodge, you know, for us, a house where we can just use in the hunting season. We can, you know, if we want to rent it out in the skiing and so on in the summer, because we won't be there for that. And it was just a practicality. It had nothing to do with Cuba or any, you know, it had just to do with that they found that they were enjoying going out to the West more each year, and wanted to do that, but by that time, losing the Finca was, well, you know, from what I observed, was, you know, the one of the catalysts that where he's that and his health had deteriorated, so his abilities were going to be limited, both for writing and for sport. Well, just like everyone, you know, we all decline at some point if we don't get done in before then. You know, so that was, it was a natural development. His father had committed suicide. There'd been many suicides in the family. I mean, Grace's family, her uncle had committed suicide. His first wife, Hadley's father, had committed suicide.
That's right, when that's Hadley, right.
15, you know, it was, it just wasn't, it was, as he looked at it, one option. It wasn't that his mind failed. I mean, his mind, he actually, he made every detail that he wanted, you know, he wanted to make sure that his affairs were in order. It wasn't just some random, you know, desperation. It was a very well thought out, this is the best thing I could do for myself sort of thing.
Well, it looks like this episode becomes part two of a three-part episode of our continuing conversation with Valerie Hemingway. I'm Christopher Struble, host of Tales of Northern Michigan's Past, inviting you to join us for part three with our conversation with Valerie Hemingway.